Welcome to The Annotator, where composers share their thoughts and stories about their original scores. This is episode 18, where composer Christopher Willis talks about his original score for the feature film, The Death of Stalin. This is Christopher Coleman, and you can find all episodes of this podcast at theannotator.net. Christopher Willis is an Emmy-nominated, multi-talented composer working in the mediums of film, television, and games. Christopher is known for his work on HBO's hit comedy series Veep, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. He currently scores The Lion Guard and multiple Emmy Award-winning Disney Mickey Mouse shorts. One of his most recent projects was for the feature film, The Death of Stalin. The Death of Stalin is a 2017 political satire film directed by Armando Iannucci. It chronicles the Soviet power struggle set off by the death of the dictator Joseph Stalin in 1953. The film is based on the graphic novel of the same name. The film was released by E1 Films in the United Kingdom on October 20th of 2017 and is set to be released in the United States by IFC Films on March 9th, 2018. Christopher Willis's score for The Death of Stalin has garnered much praise and a nomination for Best Music at the 2017 British Independent Film Awards, and in this episode he talks about writing a score in the great Soviet tradition of music composition. He shares about how he made the jump into this classical world of music, and he talks about his road to discovery about the powerful and pompous Soviet scores as he prepared to write his own for the satire.
The film is unusual in that the soundtrack basically is in a particular world, and that is Soviet music of the 1950s. People like Shostakovich, Weinberg, to a lesser extent, Mosolov, Mayakovsky, Prokofiev, Ostvolskaya. That is a world of symphonies, operas, oratorios, but also film music. Most of them at one time or other would actually score movies, Russian movies. I'm probably going to end up getting quite technical and boring about this, but it's all in the service of trying to convey how tricky it was. Armando and I had been working together for several years on Veep, and he approached me about Stalin and basically quite breezily said, I'm thinking that it should all sound like Soviet music, it should all sound like Shostakovich and Weinberg, and we might use some bits of pre-existing classical music. We might use some of those things, but generally, I think I want a new score, but just in that style. And of course, I sort of paused and said, "Great, that's fine." Of course, inwardly thinking, "Well, that sounds like a great challenge." But of course, those are very good composers, and their music is very complicated. But I think he knew that I would be up for the challenge. We both knew that each other were big fans of classical music. He knew that I had a musicological background. I had a PhD. And we'd had little forays into different musical styles on Veep, actually. The Veep team goes to London, and we had just a brief kind of William Walton, Benjamin Britten pastiche. And they go to Finland, and we have a quick Sibelius pastiche. So I think he knew secretly that I'd be up for the challenge. I think that the idea of doing a score that's very much in a particular historical voice, actually, it sounds odd, but there's an interesting historical precedent for that. I think in a certain kind of comedy. To me, the classic is Young Frankenstein, where the score is just perfectly embodying that 1930s Hollywood sound, and it stays in character, doesn't break character, it's almost like method acting. And although our film is not a spoof, which Young Frankenstein is, I think that's sort of that's something similar is operating. And something I think that's interesting about it is that you can hear the music as being very ironic. So basically it's huge, it's very big, very Russian, very dark. You can hear that as being ironic and playing against what you're looking at and making it seem more absurd. Or actually it can turn and you can hear it as being very sincere and prompting you to think about how tragic what's actually happening in the film is, that we're seeing people being very silly, but actually outside the Kremlin, out in the world, everyday Russians are suffering terribly as a consequence of what we're seeing. And I think you can see the whole film like that too. You can be finding it hilarious and then quite suddenly you can turn and realize how terrifying and depressing it all actually is. The movie starts at a classical concert, and what happens to the classical concert and how Stalin reacts to it tells us a lot about the state of terror in which the whole country is. This cue that we're hearing here is just a moment when a recording of the Mozart piano concerto that was being played is being conveyed out of Moscow to Stalin. We're seeing the record changing hands. And we just thought it would be nice to have a moment when you could hear a connection between the world of the score and the world of the concerto. So that's sort of, it's actually a texture, very similar to a texture from the Mozart, but the tonality has that slight dissonance and bitterness that you associate with the Soviets. This cue is Removal Men. This is used for a really great and bizarre scene when Stalin's country home, his dacha, is being liquidated, and all of his staff, his chefs and his maids and even his stand-ins, these guys that look like him, are all being carted away or shot. This is the main theme of the film, really, that we're hearing right now, which, to me, I don't really associate with one character in particular. It's the situation. It's the setup of the film. Perhaps it relates to Khrushchev. It's tragic. Feels tragic. There's a lot of falling lines in it. It also works against itself as a canon. Which I sort of exploited basically the same rhythmic feature that it has several different times, so that we hear quite a few fugal and canonic things, although actually it's really the same mechanical thing that's there in the theme waiting to be exploited. There's another theme that I definitely associate with Beria. Beria and Khrushchev being the two antagonists of the thing, and we hear those two themes coming and going, alternating in lots of different ways. We're about to hear something that plays for one of the scenes in Stalin's funeral. I had to spend a long time studying Soviet scores before I really could start working and writing things that I was happy with. One of the things was to grapple with the harmony of music of that time. You can hear in this cue, fairly starkly, one of the things that I picked up, which is that this music it's actually way more tonal than I thought it was. I had some idea going into it that it would all be very angular and that you would rarely feel like you were in a key, and that's completely wrong. Actually, it you generally do feel like you're in a key, and there's a whole lexicon of ways in which you push against the key. In this one, you can hear lots of times that we might be in the minor, we might be in E minor, but we might hear G sharps happening, not signifying moving away from E minor, but just rubbing as neighbor notes against a G natural, or we might hear an A sharp working against an A natural, There's a whole variety of ways in which you can do that. This one does another trick, actually, which is that you you never want to stay in the same key too long, but you don't want to suddenly jump from one key to another. There's a standard thing that we do in movies where you go along and along in one key, and then you chapterize, you jump to another key with a little flourish as the film jumps in some way. Now, the Soviets don't do that. They'll change key in the middle of a phrase with no rhetorical flourish, and often in a way where it's impossible to tell at first what key they've moved to, because they're just doing something slightly ambiguous with the accidentals. Now, there was so much music that Armando and I listened to and discussed as they were starting the edit and I was starting to work. We were sending music and links back and forth, all the sorts of Soviet things. There were lots of things that we thought, well, we should do something like that, or that has a nice sense of the general pulse that we might use in this section. There was a temp track, although the temp was very sparse, and really quite early on we started replacing what was in there with what I was doing. And there was actually tons of music that we were discussing that was never lined up with the film. And there was this wonderful composer that neither of us had heard of, Galina Ostfolskaya, and this absolutely nuts, batty chamber music that she wrote. And so that sort of bizarro piano fugue that you're listening to right now was sort of my response to some of that music that we'd been hearing. That comes at a weird point in the middle of the film when everybody who was going to be killed seems to be now alive, and everybody who was going to be alive is now being sent off to the gulags. And the music responds to that by having this crazy fugal texture with things upside down and over the top of each other and inverted. And in the film, it jumps suddenly from this disturbing situation of people coming back from the gulags to preparations for Stalin's funeral. And in the music, I jumped as well, using the same theme, but suddenly it switches to orchestra in that very festive style with bells and tambourines that the Soviets use. And that piece will come, the festive thing will come back, actually, because I went back to that and developed it for the end titles. This kind of music came to feel to me a little bit like the heartbeat of the film. This pulse, this shape comes back several times in the film. This is one of the longest cues, and it's a fairly long sequence that's got very little dialogue in, unusually for the film. And it's taking us through one of the key events later on in the film. I better not spoil it. But suffice to say, for one of the first times, we're seeing large numbers of people. We're seeing crowds, and we're seeing the sheer scale of the country itself. Another misconception I had about this Soviet repertoire was to do with the syntax of it, the musical logic from one bar to another. There were probably a few neoclassical pieces that I heard a long time ago that misled me. I had this idea that it was going to be in these four-bar blocks, but that it was going to zigzag a lot. So after four bars, it would jump wildly to some other place. And that's really not typical at all, actually. In trying to zigzag and do unexpected things, I was overreacting. And in the end, I learned how to keep going with one melodic idea, with one rhythmic idea, as you're hearing here, but shifting the harmonic footing so that you might hear one gesture and think, okay, that's the tonic. Then you hear another gesture and you think, oh, I'm not sure if either of those is the tonic. Maybe the second one's the tonic. Then you hear a third gesture and you're like, oh, no, okay, this is the tonic, and neither of those were. and you keep playing games like that, and so you create a sort of underlying restlessness, even though the melody is going round and round in this ostensibly repetitive way. I should say, actually, in case it sounds like I'm completely insane, nobody actually thinks like that consciously when they're listening to music, but I think that is what your brain is doing involuntarily. You don't realize your brain is doing that, but that's what it's doing. I'm a big fan of Stravinsky, although I think mostly he's a little bit of a red herring when you're studying this kind of thing, except for folk tunes that they were referencing are very much the same. So you can practically, I don't know my Russian folk tunes that well, but it seems to my ears you can hear the same tunes turning up in Weinberg symphonies as you do in The Rite of Spring. I should say a word or two about Weinberg. That's someone I had not heard of at all when I first started working on this. He was a little bit younger than Shostakovich, and they were colleagues, and he really doesn't have a big following now, but he is fantastic. So that was a great discovery. I got very into his fourth symphony. It was slightly difficult to get hold of the score, but I got hold of the score, and it's very educational. It's important to spend some time on the orchestration language of these composers. I tended to find there were certain things that I knew from before and that I think a lot of composers know. Big woodwind sections. We had four flutes, four clarinets. You often have all the woodwinds in unison, or rather in octaves, playing together. That's just a classic sort of Russian 20th century sound. Very unabashed use of the clarinets, especially the E-flat clarinet. Let the woodwinds be very bright and aggressive. This is a very aggressive cue, but actually the brass section doesn't need to be huge. As long as you let them breathe and allow them to play really loud. Used classic brass tricks like having the trombones in three octaves. They sound immense even though there's only three of them. There's some stuff like this that actually gets very tonal, very traditional, and the inspiration really was more the film music by the Soviets than their symphonies. When they were doing that kind of work, they often went very tonal, and it has this sort of pomposity and grandeur that in certain places in the film was very funny and very useful. We needed very high timpani for this. In fact, we didn't have a timpani high enough to play that high C, so we actually had to do the timpani part a full step lower and pitch it up later. But I think it sounded great. The orchestra was recorded at Galaxy Studios in Belgium. What the orchestra played wonderfully, and the studio sounded super. And then it was mixed back in LA by Satoshi Noguchi. And we worked, I mean, he mostly worked, we worked very hard actually afterwards on thinking about the difference between the way a modern film score sounds and the way a classical recording sounds, you know, say a Russian recording from the 70s, say, might sound. We listened to a lot of recordings that we really liked, Russian ones, but also other ones, Decca recordings from the 70s, say. And there's a darkness to those classical recordings that's quite different from the way a film score sounds. So we actually darkened the sound, and it's quite a long tail. A lot of the halls that you record in for classical music are bigger than the stages that we use for film music. But it's quite common in a classical recording for the orchestra to be at one end of a hall as though they were playing to an audience. And then you have the microphones behind them, and then you have this huge space with nothing in it. It's a very different acoustical situation from having a scoring stage and just having the whole room full of the orchestra. I'd like to see sometime if I can make a suite of music that you could play in a concert hall. out of this material. But as it was recorded, the score is focused on the film and a lot of the cues are quite short. In some cases, I had ideas for how the soundtrack album might work, and we actually recorded extra music so as to have two different versions. But for other parts of the score, it was just a case of looking at these shorter cues and working out how they could be dovetailed to make longer tracks. And I actually had two soundtrack editors help me with this because it was so intricate and tricky. Andy Glenn, who's the original music editor, and my wife Elise, and they both helped me enormously. I grew up very much writing on paper, composing pencil on paper. Then I came to LA and was thrust into doing everything using computers. I was at Remote Control Productions for a few years, working for Rupert Gregson Williams. And what I've done more recently is to reintroduce working on paper, just for the bits where I think it's really, really valuable. If I'm writing a tune, I find that it's much easier to write it on paper than any other way. I can just say, I know what these three notes are going to be, but I don't know anything else. And you can just put them down on the piece of paper. And then I'll come over to the computer and I'll compose at the computer, but just using a piano and ignoring the grid, ignoring the sense of click track. I'm just composing. And then I do the click track after the composing. And then finally, I'll start worrying about programming it. And like most composers, I have lots and lots of libraries and it's very arduous. One single line of music might actually be several different patches in alternating, several different libraries, actually, so as to try and sell the cue and make it sound as realistic as possible. Then when we actually record the orchestra, we throw all of the program stuff away. So at the end of the film, there are some end titles. There's an end title sequence, and I was able to go back to the piece that was used for the Stalin's funeral preparations and turn it into a complete piece of music, which is what we're hearing now. And feels to me, it's almost like an overture. It's a very traditional opportunity, although it's at the end rather than the beginning. Opportunity to sort of express how I felt about the whole film, about its tempo, about its humour, about the weird, bitter, dark comedy of it. It's also a chance to bring back the themes that we've been listening to and really to complete this sort of conceit which I had in mind, that we should feel the whole way through the film like we're listening to some symphony that we don't know, slightly preposterous, crazy Soviet symphony, and we're just getting bits and pieces of it, and here we are at the finale. Anyway, well, thanks for listening. Cheers, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Annotator with Christopher Willis and his original score for The Death of Stalin. The original score by Christopher Willis was released on December 1st, 2017 and can be found on Amazon.com, iTunes, or streaming on Spotify. You can also hear more of his music and find out more about Christopher Willis at his official site, ChristopherWillisComposer.com, or follow him on Twitter at Mr. Chris Willis. The Annotator is produced by me, Christopher Coleman, and you can find more episodes at theannotator.net, or you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Podcasts, or wherever you find quality podcasts. Wherever you do listen, please leave us a rating or a review, and please share this show with someone you think who will appreciate it. You can also follow the show on Twitter at Audio Annotator, or on Facebook at The Annotator, or send us your feedback via email to theannotatorpodcast@gmail.com.